your committee caucus meeting.
Good morning. The chat, is the tape on? Yes? We think the tape is on. Good morning. I'm going to call the tax committee to order, and we're going to ask Commissioner Ines to join us. As you can see, we don't yet have a quorum, but Commissioner Ines, before you finish with the governor's tax proposals, I hope you got the message. We were trying to close the loop on a discussion on laptops last year. Might have been 2 years ago.
I had to refresh my memory. It was last year.
Okay, last year. And we said we would have you back to get that information, and you know, you had said on the tape you wanted to do that, and I did too, and then I forgot about it.
Right.
And so I just want to, from people who weren't on the committee, they won't remember at all, but I just want to close the loop on that so Minnesotans who may have been tracking that issue can understand what the result of your inquiry was. So, right. Commissioner Ines, welcome.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Ward Ines with the Department of Revenue, and Madam Chair, you're absolutely right. It was last year, and it was early in session, and we were in the process of completing our physical inventory, which we do once every 2 years, and that includes an inventory of everything from furniture, basically every asset over $2,000 plus our laptops. And we do that every 2 years in inventory. And at that point, we hadn't completed the inventory. We have completed the inventory. We have 847 laptops in our agency. And after the two-year, like we call it the two-year inventory, 9 laptops were missing. We're missing. I want to emphasize that none of those laptops had extra information on it. They were all from support positions within the agency. And so none of them had private information on them. All of our laptops are now encrypted. We have 100% encryption. And since these 9 laptops, which represent a little about 1% of our total laptop allotment, we have instituted some other safeguards. Because I think what happens is that the auditors who have the taxpayer information, people who actually have taxpayer information on a laptop, are extremely vigilant about protecting that asset. They know that it's private information on there. They have to have the laptop in order to do their job. They're out in the field lab and they lose their laptop. They're out of service. So they've been much more vigilant. I would say our support functions in the inside agency have been a little bit looser because they don't have taxpayer information on it and the computers aren't as vigilantly guarded as they needed to be. So what we've done is we've instituted 100% encryption on all our laptops. We've required cable locks on all laptops, even when they're in your office. So if it's your primary computer, it's your laptop, you have to have a cable lock on that laptop at all times to an immovable object, either your modular furniture or your desk or something, because we think there's been some internal theft, in all honesty, from these laptops. So we've done that, and we're now doing, we've also designated inventory person for every division. So there's a point person that's responsible in every division for tracking each individual laptop asset. Right before, it was more centralized, and the divisions weren't doing as good a job as they needed to do of saying, okay, Chairman Chesky has laptop number 147. You know, write that. You know, I have a master ledger. So now we have a point person for every division to ensure that the laptops are traced to an individual. You can't just, in the past, like one of the laptops that was missing was one that was used exclusively for PowerPoint. So it would make the rounds in the division saying, well, you have a PowerPoint this week here, take my laptop and use it and give it back. So there wasn't enough kind of control as far as who is responsible for each individual laptop. So I think we've put in some very good protocols to address that. This fall, we begin another inventory, and we'd be happy to come back January of next year, February, and report on that. I'm confident that the result will be better than it was this last inventory.
All right, thank you for that, Commissioner. And just for members who are just arriving, we're just closing a loop from last year. It was actually former Representative Bela Forrest and Representative Dabney, I think, who really asked all the sort of pointed questions, and we all learned some things last year, and I never asked the Commissioner to report back. We both kind of forgot about it, so we wanted to get that done, and it's good to hear, Commissioner. I should also tell the committee that, you know, everybody's trying to walk through zero-based budgeting in their committees, and you know, really just to remind this committee that the Department of Revenue really received that treatment, I guess, from State Gov Finance. So I know that Representative Khan will be working to understand what the priorities are within the department. We, of course, will be trying to look at the whole budget from a zero-based perspective, both in Representative Marquardt's committee, and he's been doing that already, walking through line by line with help from Representative Lanning, on what the state is currently spending money on, and then we'll be doing it here too. But the actual work of the department is under the State Gov Finance budget. And so Representative Kahn will be working on that. If members on the tax committee would like to get more from the Department of Revenue, we certainly could have Commissioner Innes walk through his budget, his personal budget with us for our own edification, but really that account does not fit in this committee. So it's a little confusing, but just one for people who might be wondering when will that take place, I'm not intending for it to take place in this committee unless somebody would really like it to. So with that, back to the governor's budget proposal in the tax area. And I think we only got through one item, Commissioner, and that was the corporate tax cap. So we have a lot to do.
That is correct, Madam Chair. But can I respond to your comment about our budget? Because I would be more than happy to come here and walk through our budget. I know Representative Kahn has primary jurisdiction, but I know many folks on this committee, especially you, Madam Chair, were big advocates on our behalf for integrated tax. And we're coming back to ask for the remainder that's due on that to make that project complete. And I think walking through that and why that's our highest priority is important, not only for that committee, but for the tax committee, because it does have implications on our tax system, on collection, on compliance, on security. And so I know you were a great advocate for us, Matt. So I'd like to come back and just kind of close the loop on that as well and talk about our budget in its entirety.
Okay, so did everybody track that? Commissioner Innes, he wants to convince us why he needs this system, and he wants to build a whole bunch more legislators who are advocates for the funding for that, and so that we can all tell Representative Kahn's committee why Commissioner Innes needs that. And I'm kidding around now, but it is really important what the commissioner is raising, that the integrated tax system that they've been working on really benefits this committee tremendously overall in trying to work through the tax code. So if you want to come back and tell us about that, that's probably appropriate. As far as scrutinizing page and line in your budget, I really don't want to spend committee time to do that since you'll have to do it again with Representative Kahn. But I think it's important for those who may not know what the Department of Revenue has been trying to do in getting their whole system computerized in a way that everybody talks to each other. They're still looking for the rest of the funding in that area.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yes. And Representative Broad.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And I just wanted to tell you that I appreciate what you and Representative Marquardt are doing related to those line items, because I keep hearing all this discussion about zero-based budgeting. One, I'm not finding any performance standards out there, but I think there's some confusion actually to what it is. And so as we spend all this time talking about the governor's budget, if the majority is really doing zero-based budgeting, the budget ought to be moving along in terms of the process anyway, because what the governor does is somewhat irrelevant if you're doing a real zero-based budgeting system. And so I do appreciate what you and Representative Marquardt are doing, because I'm not seeing that zero-based budgeting ideal really come to fruition in most of the other committees.
Representative Carlson.
Maybe I could comment on that. We've done a fair amount of research looking at other states, and there's not a state in the union that does zero-based budgeting. There's a lot of states that use that terminology, including Georgia. If you'll remember, well, maybe some of you don't, but when Jimmy Carter was president, that was he emphasized that he had implemented a zero-based budget. Well, what most states have is priority, a form of priority-based budget, which is a little bit different, but where you ask a given agency then to categorize what their priorities are. They might have high, medium, low. Be asked if your budget level was set at a 10% reduction or a 20% reduction, what your priority would be. And that's what most states do. And I think you'll hear in the finance division more discussion about priority-based budgeting when you get over to the finance side, as opposed to zero-based. But quite frankly, people in this administration and within the legislature often use the two terms interchangeably.
Right.
And so a little vocabulary building may be thought priority-based, at least from a finance division side.
And Madam Chair, and I appreciate that explanation, because you're absolutely right. You know, when I heard all summer about the zero-based budgeting, I was really excited about the fact that people were actually going to dig down and start looking at where we actually spend money in the state. And I'm looking forward to people actually being able to see where we spend money by passing the transparency bill that I have. But I give myself a little plug. But I do think that what you say is important as we try to seek priorities and as we evaluate the governor's budget. I mean, it's really interesting and it's important that we're evaluating what the governor is doing. But in reality, it's the House that has to start moving forward and the Senate has to start moving forward. And while we go out and bash on the governor here and there about this, that, or the other thing, at some point, soon, we've got to get a budget going on both the House and the Senate. And so my hope is that we do less bashing and more priority-based budgeting, or zero-based budgeting, whatever terminology you're using. But I appreciate the explanation because I think you're absolutely right.
Thank you, Representative Broad. And Representative Carlson, and it is semantics. I stand corrected as well. There's a lot of nuances, the Strategic Performance Outcome Bureau. And I think that the finance chair here has given chairs a lot of flexibility to kind of think through what works best in their committee because we're all very different in that regard. But I do know for beyond, the other committees in the legislature and watching, I think the House Tax Committee is unlike any other committee that I have seen as far as walking through in a real, bottom line way. And that's why we spent January and just finished yesterday on overview. That's really where members see the big tax code and all of its complications and put it in perspective. And so having all that time spent on property taxes yesterday or the income tax, sales tax, all the kinds of things are helping members frame what should we stop doing? What can't we afford anymore? What should we change? What isn't fair? And we're all going to disagree on that, but that's why those House research overviews in the tax committee are so important because they help members really kind of take it down to the zero-based level and think through what we might have to do differently. So I really appreciate that members have attended those and asked really good questions because there's just so much there. I think the federal conformity bill debate, that alone shows members how complicated things are, and so for a taxpayer to really be paid in line, I think is virtually impossible. Just to have the federal conformity testimony that was given by Ms. Manzi and Mr. Michael, just in that one bill, it just shows how complex the system really is, but we're trying to distill it down, and I think the overview has really helped members with that. And so now we're off to the governor's budget, and I think the commissioner has some of us may agree or not agree. I personally think the way the commissioner is going through it is probably the better way, is just the change items. We could ask the commissioner to do everything under the sun, but I think what we're most interested for today and for thinking about the governor's budget is just the change items that the commissioner has been walking us through, and so we want to continue with that. We only did one page, and we spent a whole committee on that page. So we do want to continue to work through all the business tax credits and incentives next, I think, and then work through aids and credits.
Correct.
So thank you, members. With that, Commissioner Innes, if you can direct us to what we're looking at.
Madam Chair, you're absolutely right. We got through the one provision on corporate franchise tax. It was page 6 of the change item for this document that you're all familiar with. So we've moved on to page 7, which is titled the reinvestment tax credit. And that's a credit the governor's proposing, a $50 million reinvestment tax credit, a refundable reinvestment tax credit.
One second, Commissioner, I apologize. Does everyone have this? Okay, so it's this one. And if you don't have it, the pages have one for you. It's called Tax Policy, Aids, and Credits, which is a little, it looks like you're looking at property tax, but it's everything. And it's about 25 pages, and we did the first page. Okay, so that's what we're on. Now we're going to page 2. Right, Commissioner, is that right? Or actually it's page 6
actually
or 7?
Page 7. The beginning part is just a spreadsheet and some other narrative.
Okay, so we... Page 7. Does everyone find that? Can you just flag the pages if you don't? And Megan and James will bring you one if you don't have one. Okay, Commissioner, thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, this is a reinvestment tax credit. It's a 25% refundable tax credit that's meant to incent investment for small businesses to make investments in the short term. We've structured it in such a way that we want the money to go out as quickly as possible. So we provided about a 90-day window for these small businesses to make the investment. The investment's primarily targeted at those businesses that are less than 100 employees. They'll get the full benefit of the 25% credit up to a maximum of $5,000. The sort of investments that would be eligible for this credit would be the things that are all already eligible for the 179 expensing, which we'll talk about in a little while here. But that includes everything from machinery, equipment, furniture, cash registers, computers, all those sort of things would be eligible for this credit. And it's part of an effort. We have what I call a three-pronged approach to try to incent small businesses to make some investments in the short term and maybe jumpstart their business, maybe hire some additional employees. We have this provision, which is a refundable credit, so even if you don't have a net tax liability, you'll get the benefit of this credit. We also have the 179 extension, which we'll talk about shortly. We're conforming to that to provide additional incentive. And another issue you've heard about for many years, I think, the upfront exemption on capital equipment. So we've kind of packaged those three together. They all will benefit small businesses, and hopefully that'll provide a little bit of a jump start to those small businesses. But this is the one component, is this $50 million tax credit. We don't know exactly what the appetite is going to be out there in this uncertain economy, so we capped it at $50 million to limit our budgetary exposure, and it's limited for 90 days. We'd have to make the investment within the 90 days. And we're open to recommendations from this committee as well, because this is an idea of first blush. I mean, it's nothing we've done before. And so we have a lot of discussion inside the department about the best way to structure it. We think we should bifurcate it, separate it from the return. So if they make this investment, they can get the money right away rather than having to wait till the file in 09 or 010. I think this is a much needed incentive for small businesses to make some decisions. But we're open to feedback on this and what mechanism is best to do this. But we thought it was worth the discussion.
Representative Rood, then Eastland, and Murphy. Representative Rood.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this is maybe a really elementary question, but is small business defined in statute, or is it, I think the Commissioner mentioned that it was by definition here, less than 100 employees, or?
Hey, well, Commissioner, if you're comfortable to ask Mr. Michael, unless you know the statute on that.
Take a shot. We struggled with this, Madam Chair, Representative. We struggled about what definition we should use as a proxy for small businesses. And so at first we thought, well, maybe we just say, if you're eligible for the 179, if you took advantage of the 179 last year, you're eligible for this refundable credit. But then we thought we're fencing out people who may be small, who didn't take advantage of the 179. So we went back and forth. And at the end of the day, we thought, you know what? We just made our own definition, which was, if you're 100 employees or less, you get the full benefit. If you're 110 employees, you get a 20% credit, I think. And so it shaves down, but the full benefit is realized by anybody with 100 employees or less. So we struggled with which definition would cast the right net to help those we wanted to help.
Okay, thank you. And Mr. Michael, do you know, is that in statute? Is there a definition now?
Madam Chair, there is in Chapter 645 a definition of small business. To my knowledge, it's not ever used for tax purposes, though.
Okay, thank you, Representative Ruth. To that point, Representative Dietrich?
No, not to that point.
Okay.
Another question.
Okay, Representative Eastland?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner, there's a cap, a $50 million cap, but is there a cap for recipient as well?
Mm-hmm. What is Madam Chair, Representative Eastland, yes, there is. The $5,000 per business.
Representative Eastland, more?
No.
Nope. Okay, Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to the Commissioner, you mentioned that this could help small businesses hire employees as one of the outcomes, and I'm wondering if you can just talk about that a little bit more. In what way would that be helpful?
Madam Chair, Representative Murphy, we did a lot of robust discussion around this and what kind of impact it would have on employment numbers. But what we heard from business communities is that the 179 expensing along with this and a couple fund exemption on capital equipment, it would be a strong incentive to make some investments in capital equipment and other things. And you see that associated with also increasing their employment levels. I mean, if they're going to do an expansion, this may be the impetus for them going forward with that expansion rather than delaying it till a future date. And if you're going to buy computers, you're going to buy furniture, you're likely by adding employees to your payroll as well. So we thought if we can incent them to make an investment, we're hopeful, and based on our feedback from the business community, that that investment will also be have the ancillary benefit of hiring people, or potentially maybe not laying somebody off that otherwise would be laid off, for maybe retention as well. But we don't want businesses to take an indefinite time out from making investments. I mean, that is kind of the lifeblood for these small businesses. So this is hopefully a way to try to bridge that short-term pain they're in right now to help them, incent them to do some activities.
Representative Murphy, more?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just then one educational question for me, and maybe for Mr. Michael, if you could tell me what 179 expense is, please.
Good question. Section 179. Mr. Michael.
Madam Chair, Representative Murphy, that 179 refers to a section of the Internal Revenue Code that allows businesses, both C corporations, S corps, and partnerships, to rather than claim cost recovery or what people usually refer to as depreciation allowances over a period of time, to instead deduct the full amount that they pay for certain qualifying capital items in the year in which they pay for it. There's a dollar limit on the amount that they can do that, and if their total expenditures on those types of items exceed the ceiling amount, then they don't qualify, which is why it's generally thought to apply to smaller businesses, because larger businesses that buy lots of items that are depreciable don't qualify for this. Congress keeps changing the dollar amount in the bill that's now in the economic stimulus bill. There's a change in that. I don't trust my memory, but I think it's 250 and 800 now, and I'm not sure. And that's constantly expiring and getting extended. But basically, that's the concept.
Thank you, Representative Baker.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Commissioner. I think this is an interest that we all have right now, is how can we help our small businesses sustain the economic conditions that we're finding ourselves in. And it seems to me that, at least from my perception of it, is that the real issue here is the credit market has dried up, and that small businesses have difficulty even getting short-term mm-hmm. loans to help sustain the business for the long term and sustain themselves through this market. So did the governor or yourself ever look at what issuing small business loans just insured by the state?
Yes, Madam Chair, Representative Dietrich, we've been at revenue, and I did not have that discussion with the governor. I think that'd be something probably more appropriate to ask Deed, since they're in the business of giving loans and grants to businesses, whether there was some discussion about maybe a more unique loan program. Right now, I know they have things like forgivable loan programs, where if you meet certain thresholds as far as job creation and wage levels, you can forgive the loan. But that might be an appropriate question for the Deed folks. In fact, they're in the room right now, and I know there's a few provisions in this tax bill that they're the architects of. The CAPCO provision, Small Business Investment Act, the Green Jobs Z, and the Angel Investment Credit. So I have them here because if you guys want detailed discussions, they're the more appropriate people to speak to it. And it's a good question. It's a good question.
Okay, Representative Dietrich, did you have more?
No, I'm done. Thank you.
We are going to take public testimony on the governor's proposal here, and so we do want to hear from all those people. I don't know if we'll get some today, but we've got room for them from tomorrow. I think it's better to have you kind of try to get through the whole governor's proposal to us as a committee today, if we can, before we would take public testimony. And Commissioner, you know that a lot of those ideas I'm not personally a big fan of, and so I do want to have thorough discussion about all of them so people can hear why people may or may not like them, so individual members can make up their minds about them. So we do want to leave time for that, but we're going to go now to the Representative Demmer, then Loon, then Zeller. Representative Demmer.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to emphasize the importance that Commissioner, you made an excellent point, and you hit the nail right on the head when you talked about investments that then create the jobs coming after. It's not a direct job creator when you do the tax credits. But I'm just going to put a little primer in. It was brought up more, Section 179, the advanced expensing of depreciation. That's huge for small businesses that are investing, and I can tell you in the agricultural sector where individual farmers may have $1 million of equipment and they're rolling equipment over every year, this is huge. And so I know that'll be coming, I know it's coming, so I'm signed on to it, to get us conforming with the Fed. But that's huge for investments, for our businesses, and incenting that investment. And again, I just want to compliment you on your knowing that that's what it does. It creates the investment, brings in equipment, it brings in expansion, that then creates employment. That's what we're looking for.
Thank you, Representative Emmer. Representative Loon.
I thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to thank the Commissioner. And you know, I think this is a really good start, and I have a keen interest in what we can do to try to help, in particular, our small businesses that are struggling and how we can help them put people back to work and make it through this tough economic time. Could you comment on what you looked at, or if you looked at other ideas? Obviously, these will help this initiative tremendously with reinvestment in what I call more very tangible kind of bricks and mortar type of assets for businesses. But when you looked at even human capital, and I noted, I think it was New Jersey, was looking at a tax credit for small businesses for hiring new employees. And did you look at anything along those lines? And also, do you have a handle on how many businesses do you think would perhaps take advantage of this, given the parameters you've designed it with?
Commissioner. Madam Chair, Senator Bloom, we looked at the whole waterfront of things that we thought would be surgical ways of trying to incent additional employment. And one of the determiners of which route we're going to go is we wanted something that was understandable, kind of a known commodity for businesses. Something that, you know, the 179 has been around, and we haven't utilized it to its full extent, but it's been around, and we wanted something where we get the money out the door fairly quickly with a minimal amount of bureaucracy on behalf of both the agency, but more importantly, the taxpayer. So we thought about actual employment tax credits. So if you hired somebody, you got some kind of credit. What we were concerned about from that perspective was what people lay out, we thought about end runs on that, is that, you know, instead of outsourcing somebody, and that, which is a job as well, you know, they would bring somebody in-house in order to get the advantage of the credit. And so we were a little worried about how that would work and how we would confirm and verify. The one nice thing about this credit, the 179, the upfront exemption on capital equipment, is that, first of all, you have to take an investment action to get the benefit. The other thing is tangible property. It's things we can confirm on audit. We can confirm that this the business did X or Y in order to do it. And we weren't sure about the mechanism for an employment credit, how that would work, how we confirm it, and whether there would be some, I don't want to say game plan, but ability to kind of work that a little bit. So that was a lot of our thought process. But we looked at all the different levers that are at our disposal, and I'm sure Deed looked at a lot of levers, too, in their portfolio about what they could do. But that was kind of, we came back to something we thought was easy. We piggybacked on a kind of existing law with the 179 capital equipment exemption. And then it's something we could get the money out the door as quickly as possible. Now it's kind of our thought process.
Representative Loon, further?
I don't know if you caught the second part of that. How many businesses do you think will project take advantage of this?
Madam Chair, Representative Loon, I'm trying to refresh my memory here, but we know how many people took advantage of 179, and it was a couple hundred thousand employers that do businesses. Now that includes everybody from sole proprietorships to S-corps to, you know, the whole waterfront. Now, because that's last year's, that number was like 2 years old. So in this economy, we're not quite sure about whether it'll be significantly less than that. But it was hundreds of thousands of businesses took advantage of 179. So we don't know, and that's one reason why we had to cap this. Because it's a potential, and we hope that a lot of people take advantage of it, and hopefully we will run out of the $50 million within the 90 days and get the money out in the marketplace, get the money out in the economy. But we just don't know. It's kind of uncharted territory. I don't think there's a precedent. Joel Michaels could speak to this. I don't think there's any precedent for a credit of this nature in the time frame we're talking about that's separated from the return. So it's kind of a new ground we're traversing on, and we wanted to make sure it works.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Actually, it's a follow-up to what Representative Dietrich was talking about, the concern with small business stuff. We keep hearing that there's absolutely no credit. It's frozen. It's, you know, the worst market since 1929, all the doomsday stuff. I'm just curious, and if you want to pitch this to the Deed folks, that's fine too, but I'm really, is it anecdotal? Do you have people coming to you every day saying, I can't get a loan to buy a new truck for deliveries? I guess I want to know the, and if you don't, that's fine too, but the depth and breadth of this, at least in Minnesota, is it true, or is it just, are we talking down our own economy, or are we, you know, making the pitch for dire situations so we can do whatever we want? I'm just curious, because the folks that I've talked to in small business haven't been coming and saying this is the problem that they're having, but yet it's what we read in the paper and see on the news every night.
Madam Chair, Representative Zellers, I don't get those inquiries in the role I play, when I talked to bankers about that.
I think you have a phone-a-friend coming up.
Yeah, Mark Loftus probably does get those inquiries. But the bankers I've talked to have come up and said there is accessible credit. I mean, credit is accessible. You know, I think it's a case-by-case, and I'm sure Mark Loftus can enlighten us.
Mr. Loftus, welcome to the committee, and if you can introduce yourself, some members may not know you, so welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Mark Loftus. I'm the Director of the Business and Community Development Division at Deed. Yes, Representative, we do receive those calls. I get them personally, and our Small Business Assistance Office gets them on a regular basis. As you all know, we have a Small Business Development Center network that's being pressed to the maximum with the current conditions. They are working with companies who are trying to retool their financing, develop a plan to access more capital. The issues that we're facing are both, you know, that there is... Banks have been under increased scrutiny because of the conditions that they've been in. At the same time, companies are coming to them and saying, we need capital. The Small Business Administration has just, I think there's a 90-day period that we're in the middle of right now, where they are offering 95% guarantees on working capital loans. So, and I've had individuals call us and say, you know, well, even with that, I'm not able to access credit. So we have, it is a tough, very, very tough time, and I won't gloss over the fact that there's difficulty in the credit markets. As to whether our department has proposed any other initiatives to mitigate those circumstances, we're also in an environment where we don't have the capacity to go after significant general fund dollars or certainly to set aside loan guarantee funds. Where, and people often say that a loan guarantee would be a good idea for the department or the state to establish. It also requires, though, that you set aside funds that are not used that are held in reserve for that guarantee. So it kind of holds funds to wait for some future need for that, which isn't a terribly good idea in these circumstances. So I don't know if that answers quite the question, but the answer is yes, we get those inquiries all the time. I don't have any numbers and magnitude. It's just that all of us who work with small businesses are hearing that on a daily basis.
Thank you. President Dollars.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Well, and maybe a follow-up. I guess if we're not tracking a number on number, I guess how would it compare in recent memory and historical sense? I guess I'm just trying to get an idea of, you know, is it just a lot more prevalent in front and center because we are in the situation we're in and our federal government, you know, spending trillions of dollars, or are we kind of on a normal, you know, I would say a normal economic ebb and flow here, but I'm just curious as to how it plays historically. I'm just concerned that we're talking it up and up or down too much and that the actual numbers aren't there to support the case.
Mr. Lopp.
Madam Chair, Representative, this is a perception, but based on a lot of conversations with our small business staff, but it seems that these days companies that in past years might have been able to access credit from their bank or have just, it's just not there. So they're looking for the continued working capital, or they're trying to buy equipment to keep themselves growing to the extent that they could, and it just isn't there. So I think it probably is much tighter than it's been in the past, although we have talked to bankers, on the other hand, in other cases, who have said, well, we are ready to lend to good projects. But I think these days, the evaluation of what is a quality investment by the bank is becoming even tighter.
Well, yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. And I think, you know, from a going forward standpoint, so that if we get in the situation again, we can have some historical data so that we know, we have an idea of what we're, you know, if we're going to be throwing money out left and right, especially from the federal government standpoint, we ought to know where we've been and where we're going. And if we, you know, if it's just a matter of tracking it, if it's going back and checking interest rates, I think it's a thing for us in government, especially if we're talking about $50 million for the tax credits here and $1 trillion in stimulus package there. I think we've got to have an idea of how we're spending this money because it's not ours, the taxpayers.
Thanks. And Commissioner, on that, too, now, because we're kind of starting to drift into all of these kind of ideas, which is good, because that's, I think, how members have to think about it, is this is sort of a menu that the governor is proposing, I guess, to either create jobs or keep jobs, and Commissioner, you know that
You know, I have never really been convinced that much of what these things do anything other than what was already going to take place. And I think the empirical evidence in that regard is weak at best. We can all have different opinions about that. But to this one specifically, I guess, I would like Mr. Michael to comment on the tax application of this credit. For members to think about in picking through, do you like this one or do you like some of the ones that are coming? This incentive is actually probably, in my opinion, very inefficient as far as how tax dollars are used, because the Fed tax away a lot of the benefits. And so we're giving that up. So I know in the Workforce Development Committee and Biotech and others, they'll think about good proposals and review them. But we have to think about tax application in here, and I think this is one that has a lot of problems. Mr. Michael had told me that we also have to think about the Commerce Clause. So if I think it would just help you and me and the whole committee to just think about when we do something like this, we're letting the Fed tax away a bunch of the incentive. And so if Mr. Michael, just for everyone's education, can help people think through how a credit like this would work and then any implications for the Commerce Clause. So, Mr. Michael.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I think that this is sort of a general point that applies to any kind of business tax incentive, and actually is probably less relevant to this one than to some of the other ones. But basically, taxes are a business expense of any business, and so to the extent that business pays federal income tax, reducing their state tax has the effect of increasing their taxable income, which increases their federal tax. So from one perspective, this is good for state tax policy because it sort of evens out differences among states, for example, in different tax levels, because some of that gets borne by the federal government. But on the other hand, when you're trying to give incentives, it also sort of dampens down the effect of the incentive because the federal government is taxing away sort of part of that incentive. This credit's a little unusual in that it's refundable, and so you're going to pay it to businesses that actually don't have enough income to be subject to tax, and so that effect will be smaller for this credit, and so that's sort of a plus, I think, you can think of for this credit, because you're giving it to a business that's not going to be affected. Now, for a business like this that doesn't have enough income to have taxable income, this will still count as income to them. The IRS is going to say, hey, you got a check from the state of Minnesota, that's income to you just like as if you got a check from a customer or somebody else. And so but as you think about all of these credits, that's a factor that plays into it. Now, I think, for example, with the Angel Investment Credit, where we're talking about, just to contrast this, we're talking about very high-income investors, typically, that are making these investments. I think it's probably safe to say that nearly all of them are top-bracket income tax investors, and so the effect of that credit, you can assume that if they're in the top federal bracket, that 35% of that's really going to go to the federal government, not to them, and so it's going to dilute the effect of the incentive. With regard to the Commerce Clause, the Commerce Clause prevents states from discriminating against interstate commerce. And that means basically it's fairly complex how that plays out in individual circumstances. But basically it says the state has to be tax neutral in treating activities and investments and so forth. And obviously we're consciously here trying not to be tax neutral. We're trying to redirect investment into Minnesota, and so that probably violates the Commerce Clause, but the saving grace, and to just give you an example, the state of Wisconsin years ago, I think in the early 80s when Congress enacted ACRS depreciation, which is the fast cost recovery allowance that's used, Wisconsin said, hey, that's a great idea. We're going to allow it if you invest in Wisconsin, but if you don't invest in Wisconsin, you take the old depreciation rules. And, of course, corporations sued them and said that's not fair because you're trying to redirect investment into Wisconsin. And the Wisconsin court said, yeah, I guess you're right, and, struck down that. In effect, what we're doing here is sort of the same thing. But, again, in this case, there's probably not a lot of exposure to the state because of this unique 90-day window on this cap. So even though it's probably technically a violation of the Commerce Clause, it's probably not very likely that we'll actually get sued and lose on it. But there are other cases where that might not be the case. So that's the, you know, the 5 minutes.
And Commissioner, so hearing all that, and we have people around this table on both sides, this is not partisan, you know there are members on both sides of the aisle here who are a huge fan of these, and there are members on both sides who are not. But setting aside that, just kind of hearing that, letting the committee soak that up, I think it says that no matter what we do, whether, you know, we get down the road, that we, and I would argue there's a good argument to be made that in the time of scarce resources, we probably can't afford a lot of spending in the tax committee area, and this is spending. People like to call tax cuts, but they're actually spending for the tax committee, and they grow the deficit. They move us in the wrong direction for getting out of the problem, but to the extent that we may do some of these, I just think we need a lot of conversations where people kind of put down their swords and think through the tax mechanics, not the good deed that someone's trying to do for some company somewhere. But this is the committee that frequently is misunderstood, as you know, Commissioner, because people may not understand some of the things that Mr. Michael just said, and they'll just pass a bill. And then we all get to live with that problem, or the state gets sued, or these investors come along and say, you know, I didn't realize that 35% of my investment was actually getting taxed away by the Fed. Why'd you do it that way? So we just have to be, I think, pretty thoughtful in these changes. Representative Coles and then Marquardt. Representative Coles.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Michael, the court decision you referred to with regard to the Wisconsin tax credit, was that a state court decision? Was it a federal court decision? And can I see a copy of it?
Mr. Michael.
Madam Chair, Representative Coles, it did not make it to the U.S. Supreme Court. The Wisconsin court struck it down. In general, these disputes rarely make it into federal court because there's something called the Federal Tax Anti-Injunction Act that prevents, that essentially makes it very difficult to get federal jurisdiction. But, and yes, I can give you I can find a copy of the case and
Madam Chair, I really like this idea. I think it's creative thinking. I think it's an effort to try to inject some much needed oomph into the, you know, the Minnesota business economy. But as members know, I'm kind of a stickler for that Constitution thing, and I don't feel real comfortable about being overly supportive of something if it in fact is going to be constitutional. Now, that's just maybe Mr. Michael's very well-informed opinion, and I may ultimately disagree with his very well-informed opinion and form one of my own, but I'd like to take a look at that. I think it's an interesting issue that he's raised.
Yes, thank you, Representative. And Representative Marquardt.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. And just in kind of in the discussion that Mr. Michael had on the federal taxing away a lot of these credits, not that I would support this, but would a grant structure where grant dollars were given rather than a credit, would that avoid, it seems to me that would avoid that situation of the federal government taxing that away, and would that also solve the Commerce Clause situation? I don't know if Mr. Michael could answer that.
Mr. Michael.
Madam Chair, Representative Marquardt, a grant structure in this case, well, first of all, the refundable credit really is like a grant, and it sounds like the department's actually talking about administering it in some ways like a grant because they're not, I'm not sure, it's not clear, but it sounds like they're talking about the possibility of administering this outside the normal tax processing. Doing it as a grant does not avoid the fact that it's taxable income, potentially taxable income to the business. The saving grace may be that the business doesn't have enough total income to be subject to tax, and so in that case it works. But if you give a grant to a business that has enough income to be taxable, then it's no different than cutting their taxes, its income, to them either way. Now, in the case of the angel investment credit, which the commissioner is probably going to talk about next, that's a unique circumstance where if you structure it as a grant, you can avoid that effect because these businesses are almost all in their non-revenue phase. They're developing a product or an idea, and so they've got scientists and engineers that are working on the product, but they're not really selling it yet. And so they're incurring expenses, but they don't have actual income flowing into the business. So if you give that entity a grant, yes, it will have income, but it doesn't have enough income to be subject to tax. Whereas if you give the grant, if you give the tax credit to the high income investors, then it will reduce their state income tax deduction and it will be taxed to them. So in that case, there's a little asymmetry, but in this case, there's not.
Okay, and we're going to go to Representative Rucavina. I think, Representative Rucavina, you were coming in when we were just starting this discussion, but I think the question that Representative Marquardt just raised sort of highlights the point that I think those of us, again, bipartisanly, who oppose these credits, as opposed to those of us bipartisanly who are for them, would the opponents, like me, would argue this is really backdoor spending. It's appropriations through the tax code, and the better way to do it is to give them the money. They want the money, give them the money, and build that into Representative Rucavina's target so he can have a grant. Well, if you don't like Representative Rucavina, well, someone else is target. But I mean, the point here is... I mean, the point is that... And I heard what Mr. Loss has said about having a reserve there. It also makes you a target when the legislature comes looking for money. And I hear that. But if this is really something required in a time of scarce resources and competing with everything else in the budget, why not call it what it is? It's spending. And say it, we value it and appropriate it straight up. Don't use the tax code. Don't have all these things going on in the tax code. Have a grant program for Representative Rucavina and his committee with Deed and others to determine what are the values for what companies, to sort of pick the winners and losers or whatever, which all these proposals do, other than the straight up, you know, Section 179 or the corporate tax cut. The rest of them are picking winners and losers in the system or sectors in the economy. You know, I think that it should be a committee like Representative Rucavina who should just have the appropriation authority. And that's just a fundamental disagreement about how the tax code should work. But Representative Rucavina missed some of this, but he had his hand up. Now it might be on something unrelated, but I'd love to hear his thoughts on this. So, Representative Rucavina.
Well, Madam Chair, and I always like to jump in the middle of something where I know absolutely not what I'm talking about. But, I've got a list of jobs created since Rudy Perpich came back in 1983, mm-hmm. Commissioner Innes, and I don't remember Governor Perpich. I mean, there were definitely income tax cuts in federal, when we conformed to the new federal income tax code. Mr. Michaels helped me out when we went probably from 14 or so income tax levels in Minnesota to 3 or 2, whatever it was. But that's basically, I don't remember him talking that much about tax credits or cutting taxes for businesses. And then Governor Carlson came in 1991 for eight years, and in fact, helped me, Lynn, we raised the sales tax a little bit, gave the counties the option, and we didn't do much. But then when Governor Pawlenty got to be majority leader and Speaker Swiggum, we had the tax cuts in 1999 and 2000, the takeover in 2001, where we bought down a lot of business income tax at the school takeover. And so I'll give you the figures here. Under the Perpich administration, the average job growth for those 8 years was 35,577 jobs a year. Under Carlson, it was 47,603 jobs a year. Under Ventura, it was 23,213 jobs a year. And under Governor Pawlenty, it's been 4,298 jobs a year. So where is there any proof, at least in Minnesota, Commissioner Innes, that cutting business taxes, whether, they're corporate income taxes or whether it's job deed programs or whether it's property tax cuts for businesses, where is there any proof in these numbers that it creates jobs?
Yes, Madam Chair, Representative Rucavina, I guess my initial response is that correlation is not necessarily causation, and that even though there's been a downturn in our economy over the last...
By the way, these are my numbers, so you can try to disprove them.
No, I'm not trying to disprove them. In fact, I'll stipulate the numbers. The next question becomes, what is the causation and what is merely correlation? And, I don't know about Governor Perpich's tax record and what kind of credits that he proposed and how ambitious he was on the tax code, but we do know one we've debated here at length over the last 5 years was the FOC. And that was a tax credit or a tax provision that was put in effect on Governor Perfect's watch to help, to his credit, to help multinational companies compete overseas. And we've had a lot of discussion on this. So he understood the necessity for strategic, based on that experience at least, he understood the necessity for strategic tax cuts in order to foster a more competitive environment. And the FOC is a prime example, front and center. It probably, and we had to reform it, you know, 20 years after it was enacted, but I give him credit for that. I think that was, at the time, that made a lot of sense. And to the credit of Chairman Lanchesky and Senator Bach, we addressed some of the abuses of that. But he certainly wasn't averse to using the tax code to try to make our environment more competitive. And he had it, there was a great economy during his watch, there's no question about it.
Member where is the proof that time taxes say it's done?
Yeah, Madam Chair, Representative Rukovina, you know, picking out Minnesota is one example. We'll stipulate to the fact that our economy has been better in the past, but I also say that increasing taxes or even maintaining the status quo necessarily isn't a recipe for recovery. And we need to do some things strategically, maybe not broad-based tax reductions at this time, but strategic tax reductions to triage in the short term and provide some long-term direction to make our tax climate more competitive. Now, we meet with employers. People are making decisions on the ground about where they're going to invest, where they're going to put bodies. And I'll tell you, number one, I've said this in this committee already, number one without fail is skilled labor force, accessibility to skilled labor force. Right in your committee, that's the most important thing. But there's second and third, you pick the order, it's regulatory environment and price of doing business in Minnesota, which is tax climate. Those are second and third. And what we've heard from business people is that Minnesota has gotten complacent because they think that just because we have the best workforce in the world, one of the best workforces in the world, that trumps every other concern. In the reality, in this world where hyper-globalism, price matters, and we cannot be an outlier on our tax system and maintain our competitive edge. And we have a great labor force. I hope your committee does a lot of great things to improve on that. But we can't say that's all we have to offer at this point. And so we need to be more competitive. And whether it's reducing the corporate franchise tax or doing some of these more targeted ones, I'm open for debate on it. But the status quo isn't going to work. I mean, we're hearing from the employers. It doesn't matter if it's a large employer, like if you read the article about 3M, where the CEO squarely said, until Minnesota's climate gets better here, business climate gets better, I'm not investing in Minnesota. That is the reality. And we hear it from small employers. We hear it from Minnesota-based employers that they don't have any international operations or out-of-state operations. They say, you know, a cost of doing business here, we're an outlier. I mean, they do the cost-benefit analysis. They go talk to North Dakota and Wisconsin. You hear about these small employers who are, you know, they have 100 employees and they're being wooed from South Dakota or other states, and they have a laundry list. Our workers' comp rates are lower. Unemployment taxes are lower. We have no corporate franchise tax. Our individual income tax are lower. And they have to respond to that. They have an obligation to their shareholders, to their investors, and they're making tough decisions. Even ones who want to stay in Minnesota, they have a loyalty to the state. But at the end of the day, they need to make a profit. And they're up against competitors who are in low-cost states with good labor forces. And they need to compete against that. So it's not the whole equation, Representative Rukovina, no question about it. But we can't ignore the tax climate either. And worse yet, we can't go back to a tax code from 20 years ago and increase taxes back to where we were, you know, 20, 30 years ago. That's a recipe for disaster in my mind.
Well, Madam Chair,
Rukovina,
the long answer to my question is you don't have any proof that it's great stuff. But let me ask you this. This is another question. So if the number one concern is the same educated task force, why is the governor proposing to cut the university and the NCU system by 11%, number one? And number two, then, if it's the regulations, the regulatory things, what's being proposed to get rid of some of the basic paperwork and that? Because I know we go through it all the time. When we try to cite whether it's a power plant or a fine or whatever up north, we know that. But that's your agency
Minister,
let's ask the question. No, the most important thing that businesses are saying is a trained workforce, and why do we cut the higher education system that trains our workforce by 11% in this proposed budget?
And Commissioner, I think it's not
number three.
And I think Representative Rukovina, he's very well aware of what commissioner you are and over what area, and he knows who can really give him the detail. But I do think Representative Rukovina is making the point And I think it does bring us back to why the tax code, not straight up spending, call it what it is. And we're getting a little afield again, but, you know, the arguments that you just made in responding to Representative Rukavina, I'm sure every spending area in the budget could make those arguments. You know, we need this to get better health care. We need this for more K-12. We need this for higher ed. You're saying, or the governor is saying, we need more government money to help businesses do better. And, you know, that these proposals...
Government money.
Well, we'll call it taxpayer money. The point is, the way the state of Minnesota gets money is from the taxpayers. And so if anyone doubts that there's not taxpayer money provided in these corporate subsidies or small business subsidies, you can call it government money, taxpayer. I mean, who pays for the government? The taxpayers. So it's semantics. But we can, if anyone doubts that, we'll ask Ms. Templin to join us at the table to show us the spreadsheet for these provisions. And they are not free numbers. They're in your packets. And the business provisions cost $287 million. That's what they cost in the state budget. We either have to cut something else, $287 million, or we have to raise revenue for $287 million, and I don't think the commissioner would disagree with what I just said. These are choices. There's nothing wrong with choices, but it is spending. It is spending. Tax cuts are spending from the government's perspective. We can't make it up in the air. We have a balanced budget requirement. We either have to raise revenue or cut somebody else. So what I'm trying to say is this may be the right, we may need to go cut someone else to get these things delivered to Minnesota businesses. We may need to raise revenue to get these spending items to Minnesota businesses. I just don't want to kid ourselves that it's falling from the sky somewhere. It is about choices, and the governor has made this choice. And I think it's legitimate for both parties to think through what can we do to both do no harm to Minnesota companies and to help them do better and get healthier quicker. I just don't know that this is the right package. And I just don't want anyone to have the impression that this is free money. Commissioner, I think you would agree with me that there's a cost item on this spreadsheet for us to do these things, and this committee has to make those choices. Commissioner.
Madam Chair, I would concur from a balance sheet perspective. Every one of these provisions have a cost to the balance sheet. I do think there's a material difference between allowing a taxpayer to keep more of the money they earn versus a grant program to a constituent. Or a state appropriation. I think there's a difference, more than a philosophical, I think there's a real difference. But from a balance sheet perspective, you're absolutely right. Each one of these have a cost that has to be taken into account, and ultimately you have to pass a balanced budget to you. You're absolutely right.
And Commissioner, I mean, we would all frame these different ways, but I think this is the hard stuff this committee has to do, and this is what people who have not been on this committee before or have not been on it for long, it takes a while for this to sink in, that unlike other committees, tax cuts equal spending in this committee. That was the case when Chair Krenke said it over and over and over, and Chair Abrams said it over and over, and it has not changed. We count it. And if you want to give someone a tax cut, whether it's a lower income tax cut or a sales tax or a corporate, you name it, it's spending in this committee, and it competes in this committee's target, and it competes with the rest of the budget. So, you know, I'm just trying to have everyone think through the end game of getting out of this deficit when people are bringing new spending forward. That's all I'm trying to get through here. Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to my friend and colleague, Representative Rukavina, who asked that question, Representative Rukavina, I want to give you a real-world example. Real-world, not theoretical, not a spreadsheet, of the consequence of higher taxes. Okay? In my family, we sit down and make a decision about whether my wife is going to work. Okay? Her tax rate, her effective tax rate on the income she makes is 44.7%. That is off the top. That's before property taxes, before sales taxes, before gas taxes, liquor taxes. It is a 44.7% tax rate right off the top. So you know what she does? She doesn't work because it doesn't make sense to us. It's a risk-reward ratio. And higher taxes, and granted, it's not just state policy, and a lot of factors go into that decision, but it's a real-world example of how higher confiscation rates actually generate you less money to spend at the Capitol. And that's not theoretical, that's a real-world example.
Madam Chair.
Representative Rucavina, then Zellers, Downer, and Mullery.
Well,
Representative Rucavina.
I can give you a real world example of people who don't have to love the wife or the spouse that work for minimum wage or barely above it. I'm glad you have the ability to not, you know, to be able to have to pay a point parent to take care of your kids.
That's not the point.
A lot of people don't have that luxury. And when you factor into the, you know, Social Security tax, which everybody pays 6.5 or 6.25, whatever it is, right off the top up to, I think, is it 103 or 105,000 bucks now, and then after that they stop paying. The tax code in this country is really, really skewed. Of course, not the higher end, but the lower end, right? And so we all have our own opinion.
That's some crap.
Because, you know, Social Security isn't being just used to pay for people's retirement anymore. It's being
no
used
kidding.
To pay for somebody's kid whose parents died. It's being used to pay for maybe a Vietnam veteran who is having problems yet from his years of service years ago, and all those current veterans that are coming back and having problems and going on Social Security disability. And almost every one of my constituents in St. Louis County, Representative Gill knows his figures. We have 2% of the people in our county that stop paying that 6.25% at 103 grand. So almost everybody in St. Louis County is helping to pay for those veterans on Social Security disability. They're helping to fight the war, which is being paid for out of the trust fund, and they're paying 6.5%. And there are people walking around that don't even pay 0.1% for that. So don't talk to me about their tax codes and everything else. And maybe I got off on the subject, but you know, 6.5, whatever it is. But the bottom line again is that the most important thing to businesses is the higher education. The question never got answered by the commissioner. I realize he's not the Minsky Board of Trustees, and I'll probably ask McElroy that today. Come to the committee. It might be fun. Representative Garofalo, you know.
Representative Garofalo, one more volley. You don't have anything to throw at him, by the way, do you?
No.
Like, today? Okay.
No,
just
sure.
Making sure your pockets are empty.
That's
Representative Garofalo.
No. Although, I have to tell you, I want to come to one of your guys' caucuses sometimes, because it must be so entertaining after watching that exchange. Nonsense, Representative Rucavina,
yeah.
My point is, you're talking about a 6.2% tax, right? I'm talking about the 25% tax, the 28% tax, the 31% marginal tax rate tax. These impact people's decisions. If you want more money from me, and I'm not rich, Representative Rucavina, certainly I've been very blessed in this state and in this country, and I'm happy to pay my fair share, but if you want more money from me, don't raise my taxes, because you know what I do? I spend less, I save more, and I work less. So when you raise taxes, you are discouraging investment. You are discouraging work. It's the exact opposite of what you want. And it shouldn't even be a debate about mathematics. That's what Representative Rucavina, that is a real decision with our family, where raising rates costs you revenue, costs our state money, gives you less money in your committee as expenditures. It's not theoretical, it's real.
Representative Rucavina.
I told you, I can give you real life examples. So let's not talk about crazy taxes here, because if you want to look at the next, the chair just referred to the $271 million, it's the cost of an income for these programs. Let's look at the next seat right down below there, and the $536 million. Almost all of that, and you could throw out a little bit, like the taconite state aid, which we're going to stop giving to the mining companies probably, and I don't know the sustainable forest, but if you look at the rest of that, where's all of that $500+ million going to be made up? On everybody in this room's property taxes, on all the constituents that we serve in this room's property taxes, and on all the businesses that we represent in this room's property taxes. So don't talk to me about raising taxes, because there's over $500 million a year of tax increases in this proposal. By cutting local government aid, by cutting county aid, by cutting market value credit, renters property tax credit, there's over $500 million here.
Mm-hmm.
One of your constituents is going to pick it up in a real life situation. So it boils down to this. Whose taxes do you want to raise?
Yep.
Which I've been saying from the beginning. Patrick, Potso, my friend,
is
loyal
to
the
band. Representative, Representative Dietrich is afraid to walk past you.
Exactly.
And members, just, I know that we're getting off, and we do want to hear from the public, which like, obviously will be tomorrow, but it is so important to have the debate, because there's a lot of, you know, people are having a tough time with this. It doesn't matter what party you're in. This is really tough, and it's going to get tougher. And it's okay for dissent. That's what we're supposed to be doing here. We have to find our way through this somehow, and it's going to be together. And that's the real trick, Commissioner. It's going to be together. We need bills that get signed in the end that balance the budget. So the debate is really important, and it helps us understand each other's perspective. I mean, you know, there are people in this room who think that tax cuts are, you know, the almighty, and others that think government services are the almighty. My guess is Minnesotans value both. And it's just like, it's nice to get a tax cut, it's nice to get a government service. And we're all recipients of that. And we just need to think it through a little bit. Representative Zeller, Demmer, Mullery, Dabney, Cole. Representative Zeller.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And now that we're slightly into overviews, I can hardly wait until we get into actual bills, because if this is the pre-discussion, the meat of the tax committee is going to be a fun time. Commissioner Linus, the question I guess I have then, where can you show that raising taxes on business actually produces jobs? The state of California, the state of New York, I would say probably have some of the most egregious and exorbitant taxes on business, on tourism, on consumer goods, you name it. I heard the other day that the folks on Broadway are very upset because people aren't going to shows because their tax on drinks and food and everything else has gotten to be so high, and the Governor Patterson now is going to raise them again, that they're worried that people will stop coming. You know, I guess I'm curious as to where is it shown in Republican or Democrat alike. I know some of the governors in my party have seen it's okay. That one out in California is not exactly on the reservation, so to speak, with my principles in the Republican Party. But where is it shown that raising business taxes actually increases or improves the job climate?
And Madam Chair, Representative Zeller, I can't point to anything that shows a direct relationship between higher taxes and job growth. I think we talk a lot about New York and California, and you know, there's some tax increases on the table there. But when you peruse, there's a document that comes out every week called the state tax notes, kind of gives, you know, shows the landscape out there, what governors are proposing, what legislators are proposing. And there are very few states that are actually proposing tax increases in this environment. I mean, the vast majority, the trend is lower taxes, and if they are pushing a tax increase, whoever, it's usually something like a sin tax, a cigarette tax, gambling taxes. You do not see, I mean, take a look at those state tax notes updates, and you see very few states pulling tax increase levers. I think they all understand that in this environment, any kind of tax increase could be, you know, to the detriment of employers and job creation.
So thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Commissioner Anderson. You know, Representative Lucadina is probably one of the only few members around the table that is going to be willing to put the tax increases that he wants on the table, and I guess it's the next step, because the governor's got his proposal out here. Representative Lucadina, yours is true to form on a lot of the, and he's got it, I'm sure you've got it in the file, but go ahead, put them on the table, then we can at least have an honest debate. So far, it's been a one-sided debate. We hate the governor, his budget sucks, but we don't have anything on our side. Put them on the table. I think that's a fair, and whatever they are, go ahead and put them on the table. But the alternative isn't to say everything that the governor is proposing is horrible and yet have nothing on there. I credit you because you're the only one honest enough to put on the table what taxes you'd increase. So far, we haven't heard the rest of it.
Representative Zeller, I don't want to drag Representative Rukabina into this again because we've got a lot of people on the list. So I will answer. Yes, I would, but I would like to respond to your question to the commissioner, because I could have anticipated the commissioner's question that, you know, no tax increases don't make things good for businesses, and I concur with that idea. But I think that's half of the equation, and we just need to be forthright about that. Business, and I don't think anyone who knows me and knows my work on the tax committee for the last 10 years would ever call me an anti-business legislator by anyone. I mean, I proposed the corporate tax cut myself. I've done many of the things that people have wanted to see happen bipartisanly and for business. What I would say, though, is, well, yes, no one likes the tax increase. Business is a large recipient of government spending, a very large recipient of government spending. So does business benefit when people pay taxes? Absolutely. We have got a skilled workforce because of it. You know, we've got commerce.
the transportation system. We watched the chamber come out for an increase in the gas tax. I don't think they did that if they didn't think they were a beneficiary. Similarly, we've got a safe country to do business in. I mean, open a company in South America and hire the guys with the machine guns to stand up on the turrets and make sure you're not robbed. We have a judicial system that much of its work is for the business community. It is not criminal. It is business-to-business litigation. We have a lot of things throughout the state spending that is an absolutely benefits business. So I don't think, and having talked to many of our business leaders in the state, both big and small, I have not heard any of them say, businesses or Minnesota's bad, government's bad, don't buy anything, it's always best to have a little teeny tiny government that has nothing to offer me. I've never heard that from anyone. I have heard take a balanced approach. You know, get us out of the top ranking. But, you know, we also need this other stuff. And I think that goes to sort of the truthful debate in my mind between the, you know, the ends of the spectrum is what is the mix between government spending, taxes, as the commissioner himself stated here today, taxes is part of it, but there's other stuff too. And that's what we all have to get our heads around. So I just don't think it's fair to talk about, you know, tax increases in the context of does business want them. Of course not. Does business want a bunch of stuff Minnesota government provides? Of course they do. And it's what levels? What levels? We don't want to be outliers. We can't get out there on the marginal tax to the point that no one wants to be here. You're right, Commissioner. Tax rankings have an effect. Yes, they do. And if anyone thinks they don't, then we can just put every tax through the roof and watch everyone leave, individuals and business. You are right. On the other hand, they are not the Holy Grail. And we have to think it through in a time of a big deficit, and it becomes, what kind of tax cuts can we spend in this committee to do the work that you're trying to achieve? So I just hope we can all keep having a well-rounded discussion on all of this. Representative Demmer.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I think it's unfortunate Representative Rugavina had to leave because, you know, quite frankly, a lot of this discussion I think you could benefit from. You know, to come in and throw out some bombs and then leave is disappointing. A couple of points, Madam Chair. You talk about spending, and I appreciate what you're saying. And quite frankly, I was going to compliment Rugavina in the context of my comments here, and so he'll not get a chance to hear that either. But I think when you talk about spending, there's a difference between, there's different types of spending. There's investing and there's expense. And business people, myself included, investing is something that you put money into that you're going to expect more out of later on. Expense is something you have to do just to maintain. And I submit that there's a difference. And as we look at incentives, if you will, whether it's individuals, whether it's businesses, we have to always keep in mind whether we're investing or think we're investing or whether we are doing an expense for something that's a service that people need to have. And that, I submit, is something we look at. And we try to find that. And within the, if we make, in the context of that, whether it's grants to business that was mentioned before, some businesses are better off with a straight cash grant. They need the capital because it depends on the business. If it's a capital-intensive type business where they need equipment and manufacturing, the capital is important, especially early on in their cycle of the age of the business. If it's later on, the capital might not be the issue. It might be the taxation. And so I submit that, and sometimes Representative Rucavina may be right. In some instances, a tax decrease is not going to save jobs or create jobs. It may save jobs. It may not create jobs. And that's where in some cases, like a grant, is going to create jobs because it's immediate dollars that can be invested as capital, create the plant and equipment within which people can be hired to then create more goods and services. So it's all contextual, Madam Chair. It's contextual in terms of the, you know, where. And one other point I'd make is it's all relational to other places. You know, the statistics that were given about the number of jobs created in different administrations, without the context of what was going on, we are not an island. Without the context of what was happening in our country. And without the context of knowing what was happening in terms of other regulatory type of things, not just in Minnesota, but in surrounding states, the data is simply data. It can't be information until we can put it in a context. And without knowing what was happening in our country, what was happening in other states in terms of their job creation, that sort of thing, and then looking at ours, comparatively, we don't know if it was good or bad. In the 20 years, which sounded like the worst, we may have been the best. Depending on what other places look like and depending on the context of the national situation. So I would submit that it's you know, taxes, whether it's taxes, whether it's grants, the size of the business makes a difference. The type of the business, is it capital intensive, like needs equipment, or is it a service type business that is ongoing and they don't have a lot of capital investment? The age of the business, you know, a brand new business is usually needing capital. A business that's mature, that's been around a long time, may not need the capital, but they may need the tax incentive to make sure they're keeping more, not just getting government money, Madam Chair, but keeping what they're earning, so that they can turn on and invest. And that gets back to the type of business. Do they have business locations in other states, other countries, or are they located only in Minnesota? That may have an effect on whether it has some good or not, and whether we create jobs or whether we export those jobs to growth in other states. Back to what Representative Ruthina said, what's the context of the job changes? Did companies in Minnesota expand in other states? Is there mature companies? Talk about the 3Ms, talk about the Honeywell, talk about the Mayos, talk about some of these larger employees. Where's their expansion going on? Where is their job increase going on? Now, it might be in other places simply because it's good for us because they need to expand their markets. It might be something that they can do. I'll personalize it in my district, McNeilus Truck and Manufacturing. Plants being built in Iowa. Plants being built in South Dakota. They're manufacturing trucks. They're manufacturing equipment that's being made all around the world. Why are they going there to build their new plants instead of close by? These things all have to be in context, Madam Chair, and I would submit that we be careful about taking, and I know, I understand politics. I understand you take a piece of information, you apply it to a different place, you can make a point. And that's why it's disappointing when people do that and then leave. So, Madam Chair, I think as we go forward with this, one last thing. When I first got elected, my first term was 2003-04 when we had the $4.5 billion deficit. We and our side of the aisle, the Republicans and conservatives, had our opportunity when we had the votes to do what we think we needed to do. Criticize, you know, how many times did we hear it's a sad day in Minnesota? And we did what we had to do. We stood up, we made changes, we made the things we thought were necessary. Two terms later, in my third term, your first term as majority, the result was a $2 billion surplus. I would now submit the tables are turned. There's an opportunity for the other side to come up with your, for you have the vote, you have the control. You now have the opportunity to apply your way of thinking in terms of philosophy, and the jury will be out in terms of how that all manifests itself going forward and to see where it takes us. Now that's very broad-based, and I hope maybe I'm wrapping something. I think it's mostly able to talk. But I think as we go forward, we'll be very interested, I will be personally very interested, and I think quite frankly, a lot of people are friends of mine, will be very interested in seeing the proposals that come forward as we're complaining about what the government has presented, as we're complaining about what other Republicans and what other people have presented. We'll be very interested in what those proposals going forward are and how you propose to take us out of this the swamp, as we heard this morning in another committee, which I thought was good. Thanks for indulging in my comments.
Thank you, Representative Hemmer. Appreciate your comments. Representative Mori. Did he go? He's gone. Represent that? Nope.
Oh, he's here.
Where is he? Oh, there he is. Represent
Maury. Chair. This is a mesmerizing debate. Put me in their sleep. And I almost hate to say anything with Representative Garofalo in the room because the last time Gunther got me on a TV show with him, he called me un-American.
Oh,
for
I
should be Gunther remembers it well. I had actually started off with a very slight thing that the commissioner said that let them keep their money. When you have a refundable tax credit, I'm not sure that that's really always appropriate, what you said there. Expanding, I think the commissioner has equated in this conversation cost of doing business with taxes, and over the 8 years I've been here and listened to businesses come in and talk about things, that's not the case, commissioner, and maybe you haven't been around all the time, but a lot of business people have come in and talked about the problem with cost of doing business, and they have not rated taxes as one of the problems, or at least high. They do have, as you said, regulations. And I just lost a 100-year-old business in my district. He said that every time he wanted to move his desk, he had to go through about 23 permits. Obviously, exaggeration, but and they went to South Dakota because of regulations. We have work comp, which is often cited as an issue. That's Minnesotans believe in taking care of people who are injured. they believe in a lot of environmental protection. And so to equate taxes with that is just completely improper. And I will go back to, you referred to earlier Commissioner McElroy. I remember being in the boardroom at Schwann's, an extremely solid Republican family, and hearing, I believe he was the CEO, Representative McElroy was in there telling them what a great job they had done that year. It might have been 2001, I just can't remember, on reducing his taxes. And he said, that's not what we asked for. We want amenities, we want roads. And McElroy kept saying, but we got your taxes reduced. And the guy from Schwann's just kept saying, that isn't what we're asking for. So I don't think that you can just make the broad statements that you're making.
Madam Chair, Representative Mullery, I'm going to respectfully disagree because I, in a former life at Deed, I sat across the table from all sorts of business owners, large businesses, multinational businesses, small businesses, little manufacturers, 5 employees, 10,000 employees. And I never had a conversation with any of them where taxes wasn't mentioned as a concern of theirs. It is always on their radar screen. You know, whether they'll say it publicly in a forum like that, but it is clear that taxes is always on their radar screen. It may not be number one, may not be number two, but of the 4 or 5 concerns that drive their investment decisions, it is nearly always in that category. You know, I've done it at Deed, I've done it in other places, I'm constantly taking the temperature of business people who aren't happy to, when the business lobbyists come up here, ask them what their members care about. And they may not say it's number one, but it's certainly part of the equation every time a decision is made. And my experience at Deed, I was there 2 years, and I got a real fast education about what our deficiencies are in Minnesota and what our strengths are. And they would say, you guys have a great workforce, highest participation rate in the country, highly skilled labor force, committed, great work ethic. But I can't do business here if you guys don't knock down some of these regulations or tax burdens. It just doesn't make sense. I have a fiduciary duty to my shareholders, to my investors, and I would be malfeasance to do business here when I can do it across the border at a 20% less. And so I got that conversation all the time. So I don't know the conversations you've had, but the conversations I've had, when the rubber hits the road and we're trying to lobby these businesses to make a decision for pro-Minnesota decisions, taxes are mentioned every time.
Madam Chair, just a follow-up. I don't say the taxes aren't mentioned, but the companies I've talked to, the ones that have testified right here, have usually listed them not in the top 5.
Okay, thank you, Commissioner. Thank you. We will see you again. Members, we are adjourned.
We've got to keep the pages.